Okay, so I was recently at the bank doing some family money stuff. As you can imagine, the Spencer financial empire requires substantial oversight. Right, hun? Then again, we may merely have been rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. I guess we'll see. But as changes were made to accounts and vast sums were transferred all onshore, I promise you. But as these things happen, paperwork was generated. And because we are not quite halfway, we have a not quite halfway through law school son, something that for some reason makes me pretend to be more legally astute than I actually am, I actually read a little of what I was signing. So the way I read it, it boils down to this. The bank will do its best with our money, and we'll take all the risk. And no, it's not written in blood, but for all intents and purposes, it might as well have been. There's not a lot of grace here. And it's wise to read contracts. You do this, I'll do that. Or you don't do this, and I won't do that. And if you do this, or that, here are the penalties. One of which might indeed be we're no longer going to do business together. That relationship's over. And this is typically the way we manage relationships in our culture, but while we do deal with contractual relationships within our church life, because they're necessary, our dominant mindset isn't contractual. It's covenantal. We are about living in covenant with God and with one another. And the notion of covenantal relationship is just a bit different than contractual relationship. That's why we talk more about the covenant of marriage than the contract of marriage in the church. Because we know right up front that things may get ugly. We know that there are going to be failures. But we're in it for the long haul. Indeed, in a covenant, the parties agree to live out their obligations no matter what, even if the other party fails in holding up their part of the agreement. So, here's the good news. God has established a covenant with us. In the sixth book of the Bible, the book of Joshua, we read the story of the people's conquest of the land of Canaan, what was for them the promised land. And you may remember that the book begins with God's call to Joshua to lead the people and take possession of the land. This was after the death of Moses. And we read of God encouraging Joshua to be strong and to be courageous, to not be afraid, because God would be there for Joshua and the people. The book goes on to describe the conquest, followed by a portion of the land for each of the 12 tribes. And then in the final two chapters, there's a farewell speech by Joshua, a part of which we heard this morning. When we pick up the story, it's in the book's last chapter. And Joshua has gotten very old. In fact, he dies shortly after this exchange with the people of Israel. We're told at the ripe age of 110, or as we say in Qualicum, in his prime. It never gets old here, because we get old here. Things are good for these former slaves. Much less so for the people they've conquered, we can safely say. But for the people of Israel now, they have a land and they have a future. They are seeing what they believe to be the fulfillment of God's promise to them. So things couldn't be better. Which experience should tell us that this is precisely the time when people are most vulnerable. Because when times are tough, it's usually a bunch easier to hold on to the mission. Opposition can provide all sorts of clarity. Opposition can keep us on our game. But when things are good, when you're enjoying the fruits of your labor, what would be the current analogy? When you finally got that job that you've always wanted. Or at last the kids leave home and you have freedom and the independence that freedom affords you, Or you finally retire to a pretty place by the sea with a decent pension and a few bucks in the bank. I'm just thinking out loud here. But those might be times when we are most vulnerable to some, how shall I put this, to some slippage, to some drift. Now Joshua wasn't just old, but he had walked closely with God. He knew God like Moses knew God as a friend. And he was wise and he was faithful. And he knew just how dangerous this present situation was, how vulnerable the people were at this time. Heck, it was even within the realm of possibility that they might even begin to forget that they even needed God anymore. Because after all, they'd gotten to the promised land. And so there was some danger they might lose sight of God in this new life. After all, they'd struggled hard in battling the Canaanites. They'd lost a few good people along the way. They'd endured all sorts of privations to get where they were. They postponed summer vacations so they could sock away some more money in retirement accounts, as it were. And by now, by the sweat of their brow, no one else's, their own, through sheer hard work and a bit of good fortune, they had now got what they'd been working towards, a land of their own, and good cycling paths and wide fairways. They write it as green pastures, but that's what they really mean. And sometimes when you work so hard and endure so much, it's possible to get to forgetting that it's God who's really behind this whole enterprise. It's easy to misplace the fact that at the end of the day, our next heartbeat is a gift. It's not an entitlement. It's not just the result of a good exercise regimen, a balanced diet, regular doses of supplements, and a dram of single malt at bedtime. It's a gift from God, a God who loves us to bits. Never mind God being the ultimate source of whatever prosperity and achievements we may have been blessed with in this life. It's not hard to slip into thinking that it's really about me and what I've done. As you've heard before, Tevis and I have quite fallen in love with the south of France. And it's not just the climate, though. In Provence, it's pretty darn nice. But there's a really rich culture there that's familiar in some ways and quite different in others. We've enjoyed being immersed in it, and we found ourselves slipping into those Provençal ways of being with surprising ease. The food we eat, the hours we keep, the way we dress, even the conversations we have, we rapidly adapt to our surroundings. I think that's pretty normal. Many of you have told me about similar experiences in traveling to and living in different parts of the world. You start to take on your own surroundings. Oftentimes, that's really the smartest thing to do, adapt. But of course, there's challenges with adaptation as well. I mean, if you're a small business owner, how do you observe a Sabbath when everyone else is open 7 days a week? How do you adapt to that? And when your kids' teams only play on Sunday mornings, how do you adapt to that? I mean, and is that even a ditch to die in? This is the kind of question that was challenging the people of Israel in their new land. See, there was a great temptation to take on some of the practices, including some of the attachments to the false gods of the Canaanites and the other non-Hebrew people in the neighborhood. And in doing this, they would be misplacing their calling by God to be God's chosen people. Chosen why? To be a light to the world, to point to the one true God. Now Joshua knew of this vulnerability, so he called the people together in a place called Shechem, which is in what we would call today Nablus. And so he starts to go over the story with them. Tells it one more time, just like in the song. He reminds the people of how it all began. It's important to do that regularly, I think. Answer the question of how did we get here? That's what yesterday, Remembrance Day, was very much about. How did we get here? Remember. It's hard to know where you're going if you don't know who you are and where you've come from. So Joshua tells the story from the call of Abraham to the journey to Canaan, and that was the first part we heard in our reading. And then in the verses in between, the parts I left out, He reminds them of the time in Egypt and their exodus from slavery, the time in the wilderness and their taking possession of the promised land. And then, of course, he gets to the meat of the matter. Who are you worshiping, folks? Which false gods have you picked up along the way? Because I'm catching a whiff of those Egyptian gods and some of those Amorite gods, he said. So it's a trip back to that first commandment. No other gods allowed, just the one true God. And so he puts it out there. Choose this day whom you will serve. And just for the record, says Joshua, as for me and my household, we're going to serve the Lord. That word serve, the Hebrew word is avad. That means to work for, to labor for, to be subject to serve as subjects of God. Remember how a few weeks back we looked at the golden calf episode? How Aaron, in the absence of Moses, found himself following the people instead of doing the leading, much to their detriment? Well, that's not so with Joshua. As we talked about last week, he was prepared to risk walking the walk. He set his standards very, very high. But what comes next is interesting. The people are moved by Joshua's story. They remember who they are and where they've come from. And they say, we will never forsake God. Never. Not in 1,000 years would we leave God to worship other gods. That's pretty much what they say in verse 16. And then in the next verses they go on to say, we really do remember who we are. The one true God is our God. He brought up our ancestors from Egypt, did all those great miracles, stuck with us through thick and thin, drove out the nations from this, our promised land, declaring, we will also serve the Lord. Joshua, however, he's not so convinced, is he? Because he says, you can't do it. You're not able to worship God. God's holy, jealous. He won't put up with your sinning and your fooling around with foreign gods. He'll come down on you hard. God will destroy you. But the people declare, no, Joshua. We will serve the Lord. To which Joshua replies, okay then. Your witness is against yourselves that you've chosen God. That you'll serve him. And then they say, no worries here. We've got it. We are witnesses. Joshua then says, indicating that he knows they still don't quite get it. He says again, so put away the foreign gods that are among you. Incline your hearts to the Lord, the God of Israel. And they again reply, the Lord our God, we will serve and we will obey. So Joshua records this covenant. He writes it down so that no one can forget. Recorded the covenant, and if we were to keep reading, we'd see that he set up a monument to the fact of this covenant between God and the people. There is a problem here, isn't there? Because we've read a bit further in the Bible and we've seen that Israel will mess up. It will mess up royally. It will drift into all sorts of worshiping of other gods and won't keep God's law and will act unjustly, foolishly. They will fail horribly. How was your week? Do a good job of caring for the weakest in society? Loved your neighbor? Lived sacrificially, or carried that cross with some degree of comfort, gone the extra mile, shared the good news of Jesus, prayed without ceasing, lived fully, rejoiced in the Lord, lived and loved extravagantly, only worshiped the one true God. Not me. Love to tell you otherwise, but not me. I know I failed. Despite what was an honest and sincere commitment I made here last week to love the Lord, for he is my God. And forgive me this boldness, but I'm guessing not you either. I know not everyone enjoys saying a prayer of confession. And I appreciate that despite our attempts to make it apply widely, I know there are times when it just seems a bit distant from your experience. Words on a page, referring to someone else. And there's always that line between useful generality and applicability. And I apologize for that, and I will keep trying to bring you confessional prayers that fit us and better apply. But certainly while I have breath in my body, we will keep saying them together. For they remind us of the difficulty we have in our attempts to live up to our end of our covenantal relationship with God. And there's no more important time to remember that when we think we're doing okay. And then again, you also know it doesn't stop there. We always follow confession with a reminder of the covenant that God has made with us. A new covenant hinted at by Jeremiah, but revealed at the Last Supper and then sealed on the cross the following day through the shed blood of Jesus Christ. God is faithful to that covenant. Even when we betray, even when we deny, even when we run away and worship other gods. So we come together each week. This is an important discipline we have. We come together each week reminded of our weaknesses. And so thankful that God's more about honoring a covenant and less about enforcing a contract. In fact, each Sunday here is a kind of a renewal of that covenant that God has made with us. A covenant that, I guess you might argue, really is written in blood. Blood shed by God himself. He's that committed to maintaining it, to being with us. Every week we gather here to remember where we've come from and where we're going, to remember who we are and whose we are, gathering to rejoice in God's tenacity in constantly seeking us out, God's scandalous mercy, his truly amazing grace. I say thanks be to God.